In the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, and as Senator Monroe just said, as being a former teacher, when the bell rings, you start. So we are going to try to start promptly at 8:30. Compliments of one of my friends in the back row who complained about, or at least acknowledged the starting time for this committee. First, welcome back Barbara, who's our committee assistant. She's been with us for, 3 or 4 years, at least last session, and wonderful to have you back, Barbara. And her son is an Iraq war veteran who's here on Thursdays. He served in the Green Zone.
Oh, wow.
For what, 2 years, Barbara?
He was there for less than a year.
Less than a year.
Mm-hmm.
And is now a student at the University of Oregon Law School, and here at the Capitol on Thursdays. So we'll get to, I'm sure we'll get to meet him one of these Thursdays. Great. Senator Monroe, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Good to be back on revenue.
Any introduction? I know most of the folks know you, but if any...
I served in the legislature from 1977 to 1989. During my first session in the House, I was vice chair of revenue, and then my last two sessions in the Senate, I was chair of revenue. So I'm a little bit familiar with revenue-related issues. I'm happy to be here. I asked the Senate President to put me on revenue, and he did. So looking forward to working with Senator Deckard and Senator Starr and Senator George and all the rest of the folks.
With that, Mr. Vice Chair, Senator George, welcome back. You may have been sick last week, or I just saw you only a couple times all last week.
Oh, I was here. It's just that, I'm really easy to miss, as big as I am. No, we had, on Friday, we had a river beautification project going on up in Newburgh, series of meetings that day, so... Several people saying, where were you Friday? I was in meetings.
Beautifying which river?
The Willamette.
Beautifying the Willamette.
A great project. Two cities, the state parks and Yamhill County.
Huh. Newburgh and Dundee? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that whole riverfront. The hope is that north side of the river will look like Shampooey.
Oh, wow. Huh. That is a hidden part of Oregon. It's really wonderful that... I've only been to like two or three times, but most folks don't know how beautiful and nice it is right in that stretch of the Willamette.
We have a business that they manufacture these beautiful kiosk signs, that tell you what you're looking at out there. We invited them down to look at it, and they said we have driven through Newburgh for years. We had no idea that paradise was right down here.
Huh.
So a lot of plans in there that are going to be beneficial for everyone. Portland Metropolitan Area will be able to enjoy this. And we're hoping to get the tie-in for Shampooey up to Portland with a bicycle trail.
Oh, nice. Nice. Well, now all of us are going to find out about it. That's going to be a
you can come
blessing
and
a curse.
Yes, you can come and visit, but you can't stay.
Tom McCall, he lives to my right. Well, welcome back.
Thanks.
Senator Starr, how was your weekend?
My weekend was terrific. It was... a birthday weekend, and it was just wonderful.
So. Skiing at all, or? Oh, you did go skiing.
Yeah.
Oh. He's become quite the skier. Folks don't realize this. Mountain Meadows is taking a good portion of Timberline. Well, welcome to Robin Wilton, who's, I think this is your first time with LRO. She worked in the Senate Clerk's office. I just learned John Schoon's daughter. I didn't know that. I just learned that. So you probably remember Representative Schoon.
Representative Schoon. I absolutely did. How is your father?
He's very fine. Thank you.
And then Paul.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back for our members. I wanted to point out one thing about your staff. If you look on your public finance basic facts, our annual big thick document. On the second page there, it has a list of all of your staff and a reminder of kind of how we're organized. We have four economists, and they're assigned to areas of expertise, Mary Ayala in property taxes, Steve Meyer, School of Finance, Chris Allenack, this is his first session with us. He does our income tax, corporate and personal. Chris came to us from Department of Revenue, where he's in revenue research for 10 years. And then, of course, Mazen Malik does all the excise taxes and the transportation taxes. And Robin, and you've Barbara, our committee assistant, and Carol Phillips is here too. She's our House committee assistant.
So, hi, Carol.
We look forward to another eventful session with Senate Revenue.
Okay, so one of the documents that you have before you is our first 2 weeks before we get into the whole work plan and adopt our rules. What I wanted to do, but I don't think it's going to work out just for televising these hearings purposes.
Actually, I don't think we have that, Mr. Chair.
Oh, y'all don't?
No.
Okay, so you'll get a copy. This is just the first 2 weeks, which is we're going to spend mostly doing background. As you can see from the agenda, we tried to identify a problem since I felt Senator George, Senator Monroe, Senator Starr have all been on revenue, and it's Senator Burdick, who just told me she's on her way, has a good understanding that we would do a little less on the overview and kind of long PowerPoints and do more on taking a look at one problem as entree into a briefer perspective on the revenue system and the finance system for the state. So you'll get a copy of this shortly, which is just the first 2 weeks.
Mr. Chair, we have the agendas. I think people have the agendas for the next 2 days.
Yes.
For Tuesday and Wednesday. So, and those identify the issues and the background information.
Right. And we'll get out, probably Paul's waiting for me to thumbs up on the first 2 weeks. One of the things I'd like to do, and we're looking at least one day a week, going to the, I think it's the Indian Treaty Room, which is, I don't know if folks have been there, it's on the far, far end of the Capitol, to do more of a roundtable, which is what I wanted to do for the first 2 weeks, since Senator Starr and I talked a bit about this in the interim. And I think it's only going to work, so we'll see how that goes, to do that one or two days a week and get a little less formal and more discursive in terms of just discussing these issues and seeing if we can't get, if we can't agree on the outcomes, maybe common agreement on what our particular strengths and weaknesses of our finance system. The committee rules. So hopefully, before you are, the committee rules. And, Paul, I don't know if there's anything in here that is unique to our committee.
Mr. Chair, there is one unique rule. It's the last one, number 17. And this is the rule that grew out of a work group under the auspices of the governor's office, but it included both included Senators Morris and Prozanski and also two House members, Representatives Riley and Butler. And this group was assigned to look at the tax expenditures in our tax code, and of course you're familiar with that report that comes out on a biennial basis from Department of Revenue that lists all the tax expenditures. And one of the requirements of the report, and that report was, that statute was developed by the Revenue Committees in 1995, but it requires the state agencies to identify whether the tax expenditure is meeting its policy purpose. And one of the things we found in that work group is looking through the statutes and looking through the information available, there was very little information on what the policy purpose was of many of these tax expenditures. So this is the recommended rule that came from that work group. It's been adopted by the House. And what it says is that before a measure is reported out of committee that introduces a new tax expenditure or expands an existing one, then the tax expenditure is defined in current law and that requires that report, it shall express the policy purpose of the measure. And I've talked with the council about that. Their preference is to have the policy purpose in a preamble of the bill as a policy purpose statement, but would not appear in the statutes themselves, but we would have it in the bill, you'd be able to see that, and we'd be able to track that back when we looked at particular bills and see for future legislatures what the intent of the legislature was, and also to give agencies some guidance
and evaluating those tax expenditures and whether they're meeting what your intent was.
So any questions? 1 through 16 are pretty standard. Number 17 is would be a new rule, especially for this committee. I think the House probably has already adopted this rule.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. House has adopted it, but that would be a unique rule to the two revenue committees.
Any questions for Paul on how, I guess the salient one is, so a new tax credit, just right in the preamble there, would say the policy purpose for enacting this tax credit is X.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, you want me to move them?
Please.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that we accept the draft Senate Finance and Revenue Committee rules for the 2007 session.
Vice Chair Gary George has moved that we adopt the draft Finance Committee rules for the 2007 session. Any discussion? Any objections? We have rules to abide by. Okay, work plan. The first issue, and this is actually why we're leading with the issue, are we prepared for the next recession? The first issue that we have up on our work plan, which is after we get done with the orientation, will be the first issue we take up, is reserves, inadequate reserves. So you see that both in the work plan and the first issue today that we're going to deal with. Paul, do they have... They have the
yes, Mr. Chair. They have a draft a committee work plan, and it has the list of issues there, and also a list of kind of the things that the House has identified, as well as some kind of ongoing things that the committee normally has to deal with in terms of sunsets and reconnect and so forth.
Any discussion around the work plan? Questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, welcome, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. I apologize for being late.
It's perfectly okay. If you have any introduction also, we all went through. Senator Starr went on for like 15 minutes introducing himself, telling us about Hillsborough and the urban growth boundary, but if you have any...
Well, I've got some news about Tigard.
Oh, well.
It's in my district, and it used to be in your district,
yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I represent Southwest Portland, Tigard, King City, and part of Bull Mountain. And I won't take up any more time because I don't deserve it because I was late. Mr. Chair, I did have a question on this first item on the work plan, improvement of compliance with state income tax laws. I'm a little unclear. I understand that the actual enforcers and the auditors in the revenue department, they've actually been reduced. And I'm just wondering if that aspect of it is going to be included in our work plan, a discussion of how many auditors we need in the revenue department.
It is. So the way we've got it scheduled right now is following the second week, which is going to get right into the end of January, early February. The first issue that we have up is reserves and consideration of a couple bills dealing with building up Oregon's reserves. The second issue is the voluntary compliance initiative, which really opens the door to that whole arena. It's a bill that the Senate passed last time. It deals with folks that aren't participating that ought to be in the revenue system. But I think it leads naturally into that question of, and it came up last time, are you adequately funding the folks who are enforcing the tax laws of the state? The IRS, I think we'll get some good information from the federal government on what they've done to really beef up their enforcement program to great results, to just get more folks participating that by law should be participating in the revenue system. So I think you'll see, the short answer is yes, I think you'll see that it just comes up naturally.
Thank you.
Other thoughts or questions on the work plan before we get right into are we prepared for the next recession? You just see the second item that at least as scheduled now will be the affordable housing program that I know, Senator George, you'll remember from the interim. Mm-hmm. It's something that we had hearings and introduced a committee bill So that would be the second item, and I think the housing advocates probably will come talk to you about the $100 million package that they put together for affordable housing. All right, Paul, one of the big, big issues that we all discuss is we lived through the last recession, and are we structurally prepared for
we're gonna make it through the next one.
This next recession, which, who knows? Hopefully it'll never come, and it'll be like the 90s.
Before we begin to talk about the topic in a related matter, I did include in your material a research report on Oregon's 2% surplus kicker credit. And I had, dealt with a kicker for 18 years, I kind of had some time, and I thought I'd try to write down kind of everything I could think of about it. So I hope you'll find that useful in terms of the history. And it's an issue and very much related to the reserve issue that the chair has identified as a key one for the committee. This is looking at the state's revenue system and from different angles, one in terms of state comparisons. And I think that will give you a sense of how we respond to recessions and the business cycle in general through our revenue system and how it affects your decisions. Recent Oregon history, the way things look right now for 07-09, and one thing I should say, as we look ahead, we had a birthday in November, and that birthday was the fifth birthday of the current economic expansion. And that is the average length of expansions in the post-war period. So we're already kind of, in a sense, on borrowed time as we look ahead to the next recession. Now, the last expansion we had was the longest in U.S. history. It lasted nearly 10 years. So we can hope for that, or we can plan for this being more of an average length cycle, meaning that 07-09 would be a risky period just by the law of averages in terms of the normal length of expansions or the time between recessions. And then, as the chair has pointed out, the state's reserve position, we'll talk a little bit about that and just kind of introduce that topic for you, because I'm sure you'll be spending time on it. What I try to do is give you a sense of, try to look at the whole universe out there. And what I like to do is look at the census data, the 2003-2004 census for state and local government revenue. This is everything the census identifies. And it gives us a consistent set of numbers to compare the states. And you can see that on a dollars per person basis, adding up all the taxes in Oregon for that fiscal year, there were $2,917 in taxes collected in that fiscal year. That ranked the state number 32, with one being the highest taxes per person, 30, and number 50 being the lowest. One of the changes we've seen from the previous census in 01-02, they do this every 2 years, is the federal government revenues dropped from near the top down toward the middle. And that, of course, is an issue, too, as you look at one of your topics for Wednesday. It's been identified as a response to the possible end or a sharp reduction in federal timber payments to the counties. Another area that stands out for the state is charges for services. We've seen this shift since Measure 5 passed and property tax reductions began, that our state and our local governments have used charges for services as an important source of revenue, and a more important source than all but six states on a per-person basis. Miscellaneous and government enterprises, OLCC, public utilities that are run by municipalities. It also includes lottery money. The biggest category here, though, is interest earnings. But you can see that we do rank above average in that category as well. Insurance trust revenue, we rank near the top, but that's a bit of an anomaly because it's the biggest category, the biggest subcomponent there is a public employee retirement revenue. And during this fiscal year, 03-04, the state did issue pension obligation bonds. So that revenue shows up there, and it kind of distorts our number a little bit for that fiscal year. So we were actually 18th in this category in 01-02. So we'll see where we rank when that number, that one-time shot of revenue is pulled out. General revenue excludes this insurance trust revenue and looks at these other four categories. If you do that, we rank 28th or right near the middle. And that's kind of been where we've been in that category since the phase-in of Measure 5. And on all revenue basis, we still rank in the top 10. When you include that insurance trust revenue, we rank 7th on a per-person basis.
So, Paul, why do we so often hear, and I think I've said it, that we're in the 40s, anywhere from 40 to 44 to 42nd in terms of overall state tax burden? I'm thinking of the Tax Foundation and other.
Mr. Chair, it's right here. It's number, your number 42. That's looking at taxes and dividing it by resident personal income, total personal income in the system. So I think that's the number you're thinking of, Mr. Chair. That's the one. And that's a good measure of the tax burden on our citizens. The per capita, I think, is a better measure of how much revenue can be provided for services on a per-person basis. So the tax burden, or what economists call the effective tax rate, is that percent of income. You can also, of course, see when we look at the personal income tax, and this is the theme that comes up in terms of how we would respond to a recession, is on a percent of income basis, only New York has a higher personal income taxes as a percent of income, as we rank 2nd in the country on that basis. We have, in these next two tax categories, we've tended to be in the middle. Corporate income, we've varied around the middle for really the last 20 years. We're 22nd in percent of income, 24th. On a per capita basis, we can go drop way low during certain years because of the kicker. For example, in the 07-08 fiscal year, we have a 67% corporate credit out there projected because of the kicker. So we'll drop way down in that particular fiscal year under current law. The big change from the initiatives, measures 5 and 50, would it take this property tax, which in 88-89 ranked 5th on a per capita basis, and dropped us in the middle. That was the effect of the initiatives, dropped us from a high property tax state to an average one. One of the things I do have, by the way, in your public finance packet, I do have a table showing our ranking and each of these major components going back to the early 80s. So it shows you how it changes over time. So you can look at each year and kind of how we've changed. We've gone from a relatively high tax state, ranking in the neighborhood of 13th, 12th, 13th for a number of years in the 80s, down to 42nd. So again, that's the effect of those initiatives. On general sales taxes, we're 47th. We're tied with three other states. Alaska doesn't have a general retail sales tax, but they have some gross receipts taxes, apparently, that the census counts. So we're tied with Montana, New Hampshire, and Delaware. With zero sales tax revenue. The other question we get asked a lot is about selective sales taxes, which includes gas tax, cigarette tax, beer and wine tax, and you're likely to see some, I know we've got a number of proposals in the House looking at those excise taxes, including the governor's proposal on the cigarette tax. You can see that we rank relatively low on those selective sales taxes per person or percent of income. Other taxes here includes a weight mile tax, which kind of pushes us up toward the top. So that's where we stand in terms of our tax system. And if you narrow it down to states only and get to the question of how the state is going to respond to a recession, well, obviously the dominant factor right here is going to be the big red bar, the personal income tax. And if we were to take this graph and make 50 of them for each of the states, this would be the highest bar among the 50 states, or the highest dependence on a single tax source for a state. Washington is second at 63% for the sales tax. And Washington, actually, the census includes their B&O tax as a sales tax. So those two combined, we're still more dependent on the income tax than they are on the sales and B&O.
So, but Paul, on that slide, I've been asked, if you take, is it unfair, because if you took just a one state and broke off that U.S. averages part and put one state up there, it would look at least more like Oregon. But is that true, or would basically most states look more like the right-hand side than if you just took one state out, like you took California out? Would it at least be more, because you're taking particular states and sort of combining the U.S. average?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you're right that you know, you could have, you know, half the states look like Oregon and half look like Washington, and then you'd have a national chart like this.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not, that's typically not the way it is. We look at the western states, my next slide here. And actually, in the public finance document, I've included Montana. And I just kind of run out of room, because Montana's interesting because they don't have a sales tax either. But you can see in the west, you've got some unique systems, Nevada and Washington with no income tax. But you also have Idaho that has, you know, a system that's actually pretty close to that national average. You look at their sales tax collections at 791 and their personal income tax at 729. You also, in my table in the public finance document, you got Utah is also very similar with pretty balanced revenue system. So you do have a number of states with a balanced revenue system. You do have some of these outliers. They tend to be on the east and west coasts is where you tend to see them. And Alaska is another one. Alaska, of course, doesn't have a sales or income. It has almost all their revenue in other or excise. But California, you can see in terms of just tax burden, is well above everybody else in the region. So they raise a lot of dollars on a per capita basis. They raise a lot of dollars through the sales tax, but they're more dependent on the personal income tax. They experienced the impact of the recession almost as bad as we did, even though they have a sales tax to give them more diversification, because their revenue was so dependent on capital gains and other investment income. They have a lot of folks with very high levels of income. And so I remember at the time of the recession, the California Department of Finance was estimating that 25% of their general fund revenue was from capital gains during the peak of the stock market boom. So they have a relatively volatile system in spite of more balance. The other thing to keep in mind is, you know, you look at some of these tax burdens and you look at Nevada and you think, well, gee, Nevadans are taxed more than Oregonians. But when you look at the detail, Nevadans pay about $700 per person in excise taxes, selective sales taxes. Well, that includes a 6% gross gaming receipts tax, and that's not Nevadans who are paying that. It's a very high percentage. So if you're in that position, and Alaska is another state that's in that position where you can get out-of-state residents basically to pay your tax because of your economic structure, that's an obvious advantage. But most of these states are not in that situation, and certainly Oregon isn't. One other thing I'd say about kind of get a magnitude of these numbers, if we, for example, were to take Idaho's per person, the differential here between Idaho and Oregon, the 2054 and the 1791, and multiply it by 3.6 million, the number of Oregonians, you'd have a little over 900 million per year. In other words, if the state had the same tax burden as Idaho, it would have almost 900 million more per year in revenue. So now looking at a little bit of history, and here's some of the getting to the volatility issue here in the red line. You can see what's happening in income taxes. But the Measure 5, this 12% reduction that occurred over this five-year period of phase-in of Measure 5, first year under Measure 5, market value determined property tax revenue. Then you have the cut and cap, Measure 50, reducing revenue by about 2%. And now you've got a very smooth growth rate here. And you can see that if you look at these two revenue sources, and here's income taxes again taken off, and they're showing once again in an expansion how responsive those income taxes are. And you really get a sense of the difference in these two systems. local governments have a stable revenue source that's not very responsive to growth. So their problem, in a sense, is can't do we have revenue to meet the demands going forward? The state's problem is they've got a strong, powerful revenue producer over time, but it's not very stable. So you've got almost the opposite kinds of problems in the state and local systems. Here's just a reminder on the Measure 5 effects. Here's where our property tax rates were back in the early 90s, about $28 per thousand. And these were at a time when assessed value and market value were the same thing. And here's the phase in of Measure 5 to drop this rate down to $15 per thousand. And you can see it's flattened out, basically. And then, of course, beginning in 1997, this became assessed value and market value departed. And now assessed value, which is based on the 3% limit, annual growth per for existing property plus new construction. So you can see the gap here between these two is going to grow over time and grows more rapidly in high growth areas like Washington County, for example, where market value is growing very rapidly, whereas assessed value is limited to the 3% growth.
Senator Burdick.
On your previous slide, before Measure 5, property was very severely, residential property was underassessed. And part of Measure 5 was a requirement that the assessment be brought up to market value, and that took place, and that was why many people didn't really get much of a tax reduction residential. So isn't it true that a lot of that reduction came from the business property, which had been fully assessed?
Senator Burdick, the legislature in 1989 passed a major package to try to improve assessment, bring the cycles up to date, and began that process actually before Measure 5 was approved. It was state law before Measure 5 that property should be assessed at market value. The feeling was that it had gotten behind, so you're right that there was this kind of a lag. Measure 5 just continued that basis for property of being assessed at market value. So Measure 5 didn't change the law in that regard. It just put that in the Constitution that, you know, that you had a rate based on market value. So those two did kind of move and did kind of coincide together. But I think what happened, and getting at the issue of why there was a lot of disappointment in by homeowners, is that the trends in residential property and commercial and industrial property really went were much different beginning in the 90s. Residential property was growing 12 to 13% a year in the early phases of Measure 5. So what happened is you get the rate reduction, but then you'd have your assessed value going up 12 to 13%. So that did offset a lot of that a tax reduction. For commercial and industrial property, that wasn't happening. You didn't see that kind of growth. The market value growth was much less. So I would say, at least in my view, the reason for that was more based on market trends than it was a change in assessment practices. If you look at residential property over that five-year period and the taxes paid, it was about even. There was very little change. Most of the 12% reduction we saw in total property tax collections were due to commercial and industrial properties paying less. So this, and I think you'll see this issue when you look at kind of where local governments are. Keep in mind that this gap is a lot different in different parts of the state. In eastern Oregon, for example, this black line is a lot closer to the red line. So that, what that means is that, you know, market value is not growing much faster than assessed value because property values aren't growing much. Whereas in other high growth areas, particularly in the last couple of years, this gap is expanding.
Senator Church.
Paul, do we have a slide in here like we had last time that shows the actual growth of local government total revenue? Because we can see by this slide that, you know, it is going up, particularly Measure 5 and 50 provided a mechanism to immediately capture additional value in a region.
Senator, we do have this black line is property tax collections. So you can see that here's Measure 5. It did go down, and then go down 1 year under 50, but it's been growing about 5% a year.
But do we have also all of the other fees, system development charges and stuff that are being collected?
Those are in those census numbers I showed you, but okay. I don't have those in a time series.
Okay, thanks.
And then, of course, the other consequence of the property tax initiatives was this, basically the state getting the bulk of the responsibility for funding schools. We've seen a slight drop here. And you notice the recession years where the stable property tax was generating about 4 to 5% growth for schools, whereas the state was making large cuts in the state school fund. And each of those two biennium, both 0103 and 0305, made those cuts in the second year of the biennium, and you can see them show up very clearly here. And here's the local jumping because their property tax revenue was pretty stable. And then finally, just to look at the new revenue system from a very big picture macro perspective, this is general revenue, so I've thrown out the enterprises and the insurance funds. Taxes have gone from 54% to 48%. Where you've seen the growth is increased federal revenue. This is all percentage of total revenue, state and local government. And charges have made a big jump here. And that's, again, where you see this substitution of charges for taxes.
We're talking about. Mm-hmm.
And what are the lion's share of the charges?
The charges, the biggest charge is higher education tuition and fees.
Yep. Yep.
That is the biggest category, and of course we've seen a big jump in that category. The other one is health-related, publicly run hospitals and medical services. So health is the second biggest charge that is used. And then there's a series of minor ones, parks and those kinds of things. That
User fees,
correct.
But that's my understanding is that's a small percentage compared to tuition and the provider.
Tuition and the health-related charges are over 50% of the total. So looking at kind of this business cycle issue and how we responded to the last recession, to get us some idea how we might respond to the next, this is looking at national data for income, personal, corporate, and sales tax revenue. And you can see that it wasn't only in Oregon, but corporate income taxes and personal income taxes dropped at double-digit rates at the trough of the recession in the 01-02 fiscal year. So we saw a huge percentage drop during that period. Notice what happened to sales taxes. They were just about, you can barely see them, but they're just about flat. They're up 0.1%. So hit by the recession, but didn't see the decline. One of the things we would look at, and unfortunately, the kicker credits from last biennium are distorting the revenue stream, but a good indicator, and if we would have been a little bit wiser in the spring of 01 when you were in session, we could already see corporate income tax revenue dropping. Hmm. And that's kind of an early indicator that the economy is beginning to weaken. So we're looking at that very closely. As I say, I mean, we had, for example, in November, the state returned over $90 million in refunds to corporations. Some of that's kicker money. How much, we're not sure.
Any signs at all while you guys are watching it really closely? The March forecast will.
Mr. Chair, I think we're tracking pretty close at this point, but we'll keep you updated on kind of where we're at. You're right, you have your March forecast. It'll give you your first real strong indicator where you look like you're going to be as we come on to May. One other thing I'd say here is that notice the other side of the coin here. When the expansion begins, these income taxes take off, sales taxes growing 6% a year. So just as we saw in the 90s. We are seeing, in the 90s we saw some corporate strength here, but look how much we've seen in 2000. And if you look at corporate profits as a percentage of national income, they're the highest they've been since 1950. So there's something going on in the system. We think some of it's globalization, but the return to capital is rising. We would expect that to some extent, given, you know, this huge influx of labor in the world economy now from the absorbing the Chinese and Indian economies, the capital would be more scarce. But we've seen really an unprecedented jump in the post-war period in the corporate profits as a share of income. Of course, that tells us that this corporate income tax may be headed for a fall at some point in the not-too-distant future. The other comparison, since we do have kind of a laboratory here where we've got two state economies that certainly have some differences, but also have some real similarities in how they relate to the world and national economies. But they have, of course, radically different revenue systems. And if you look at general fund percentage change per biennium, you can see that the Washington General Fund responds to the expansion in the 90s. They had pretty strong growth in Washington, and then dropped off in the recession, and now they're taken back off again. But Oregon's is much more exaggerated. Also remember that this number, my green bar here, is a 7.5% drop. That includes, as a revenue source, $450 million in appropriation credit bonds that you authorized in the spring of 2003 in order to get through that budget. So without that borrowing, the revenue drop would have been about 12%.
Thank you. What accounts for Washington's volatility? Because I thought the sales tax made it more stable.
Senator Burdick, I mean, the sales tax bounces around a lot less than the income tax. You notice these red bars are all moving in either direction less on a percentage basis. But, you know, the sales tax is based on consumption, and consumption goes up and down over the business cycle. So a sales tax will not insulate you from the business cycle. It's just not as responsive to those changes in income as the income tax is. So you'll still have, in Washington, I mean, they had special sessions. They still had to rebalance their budgets because they were projecting revenue probably in the neighborhood of 8 to 10%, and they got a negative 1. So they had to make some adjustments, too.
Senator George.
Paul, when I look at that graph and I think back to what we were thinking and what we were saying and what we didn't do, which was what we should have done with that period from 95 up through 2001, was taking the top off of that beautiful green bar and put that into reserve accounts, but we did not. And so on one hand, we had massive revenue and great expenditure increases, but we didn't do anything to build reserve. And I'm going to be really curious if we're going to do it this time, because we have those green bars headed up again.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, so how much of that was the kicker in those beautiful green bars?
Mr. Chair, the kicker is included in these revenue numbers. The jumps would have been even bigger without the kicker. Mm-hmm. These are actual collections. Of course, this bar wouldn't have declined as much because you had a $254 million kicker in 2001-03 during that biennium, left over from the previous biennium. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's kind of a summary of our system, strengths and weaknesses. Strong state revenue growth over time, and I do have a chart, too, that I keep a little table showing general fund revenue growth back to 2931 at the time the personal income tax introduced. And you can see very strong growth historically from the personal income tax. And that has meant that over time, the state's revenue growth has been strong, certainly kept up with growth of the economy. Non-tax revenues we've talked about, charges, for example, have been used to reduce the tax burden. Now they can create other burdens as well. Proportional distribution of tax, I haven't really talked about that, but if you look at Oregon's revenue system with it, no general sales tax, reliance on the income tax, and given how the property tax works, our system's about proportional, meaning that the lowest income people pay about the same percentage as the highest. There is a slight bowl shape to it. Because of the property tax at the low end, you see a little bit higher effective rate for lower income folks, and then it does gradually begin to have a progressive tail because the income tax begins to dominate at the high end. So, but compared to most states, it's a roughly proportional system. Certainly Washington's, for example, is a regressive system.
Senator George.
Paul, you remember when we were doing all the work, the two major committees on school financing, and this was an issue that came up, and that is if you throw in sales tax, you impact, the greatest impact is on the lower income citizens of the state. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator. And you know, and if you look at kind of proposals to deal with the sales tax, usually what we've seen in the past have been some effort to try to mitigate that. And you can do that a number of ways. For example, the 93 sales tax plan that voters rejected had a low-income tax credit to help offset some of that sales tax effect. But, you know, when you get down to looking at the numbers, and of course we spent a lot of time doing this, you look at, for example, an average household of $15,000 with a household of four, $15,000 in income, their spending is about $22,000. So their spending is much higher than their income. So you look at your tax and you divide it by income, you almost can't miss but get a regressive tail there. So you'd have to use your other taxes to offset that. These other points, appropriate charges. Economists like charges because they're like the price system, and if they're, you know, they reflect the true cost, then they can be efficient. And then the stability of local revenue. We've talked about property taxes, local school revenue. Particularly under Measure 50, you look at property taxes in the recession, you hardly notice there was a recession. Basically, there's some slowing, but it essentially grew in the neighborhood of 4 to 5% a year. So very stable at the local level. Now, on the weaknesses side, the biggest one from the standpoint of, as particularly in terms of the revenue and finance committee, instability of income taxes is, of course, the biggest problem we've had to deal with in recent years. And now it's the upside of that. And it's anticipation and almost a certainty that the downside will be coming. We just don't know when. Another issue that comes up quite a bit is that whatever you tax, you do tend to discourage. And if you have high marginal income tax rates, you certainly run the risk of distorting economic decisions. You operate in an open economy. Capital, labor can move across borders with ease. And we hear a lot of stories, the capital gains, people moving to Vancouver, for example. But also in terms of just the return to labor. I mean, if you're going to hire somebody from out of state, particularly in a high-skill, high-wage position, you have to account for a 9% marginal income tax rate. And that can be a significant difference in terms of net return to labor. Federal dependence reduces policy control, and we see this in terms of tax policy with the reconnect issues, but also certainly in terms of the timber payment policy and other things that the state has to respond to. Excessive charges, and this is where tuition comes in. If they're excessive, then you may end up forcing basically people that can't afford those charges out of school in the case of tuition. And then, of course, for local governments, their concern as they look ahead is being able to respond to growth and not having a revenue system that's very responsive. Okay, to the current situation. These are all things that you're aware of. The economy is clearly on the rebound now, and the personal and corporate income tax are responding as they have in the past, and that, you know, we're always a little bit surprised. Certainly the corporate has really surprised us. As I've said, there seems to be some real fundamental changes going on in the relationship between profits and total income. And that's really why you're seeing such huge kickers out there now as we look ahead. And of course, that's the way our system responds. With our constitutional revenue limit, unexpected growth means less revenue next biennium as those credits and refunds go out in the following biennium.
Paul, I know you explained this earlier, but I'm slow. I'm slower this morning. So there's fundamental changes between income, between profits, and then income. Mm-hmm. Can you talk?
Mr. Chair, it's really kind of the shares of income. So if you look at total income, the percentage of total income that's accounted for with profits is the highest percentage since 1950. So what that means is labor income is down relative to the total. There's, labor income is much bigger than profits as a percentage. But in terms of the shares, profits have increased, labor has fallen as a share. And that, you know, economic theory tells you that should be happening when you introduce a lot of labor into the world economy. Now it becomes available and really more of a factor in the world economy, Indian and Chinese labor, then capital should be more scarce because the capital hasn't grown as much. So now that capital should get a higher return through profits. So that's kind of what we think is happening to some extent. The interest rate picture is more complicated. That interest rate should be higher, too, to reflect scarcity of capital, but that's not happening. But we think that's because of trade imbalances, particularly with between Asia and the United States. But in terms of profits, if you just divide the total amount of income, what are the sources of income? Profits have increased as a share to the highest since 1950. Which is why the stock market is doing well right now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why capital gains are up.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Which is another stability issue. Under the constitutional revenue limits, so those refunds are going out. And remember the accounting of this. They have no effect this biennium. It's next biennium where you see a drop-off in revenue. Of course, the other thing that's going on, the introduction of line games, we had anticipated about a 12% increase from line games alone and about 8 to 9% growth, you know, in existing video poker. So looking about 20% growth, now it looks like it's going to be about 36% for this buy-in. So that's why you got you had additional lottery dollars to allocate in your special session this past spring.
Have we ever had one moment when the lottery underperformed what we thought it would? One moment.
We did, Mr. Chair, and I remember it. It was in 95, 97. The video poker came online in 93, and, of course, we're in the same situation we've been in now. It blew past our estimates. So we had this big jump in lottery revenue. And so we thought, well, it'll slow down to some extent, but continue to grow fairly healthily through 95, 97 biennium. But what happened was the tribal casinos came online, and particularly Spirit Mountain came online, and that basically flattened out that growth. And so we did come into a special session in 96 and we had more general fund and reallocated general fund toward lottery programs. But that was the one time when we've come in way short of forecast. Other than that, we pretty much exceeded the forecast on a regular basis.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Berg.
Are you seeing a concurrent reduction in tribal revenues since the line games came on?
Senator, you know, the tribes, they're not forthcoming with their data. The lottery does periodically try to do some estimates on what their revenue is. And, you know, the shares have been roughly 25-75, 75 state, 25 tribes, we think, in terms of the gaming markets. But it's hard to tell what the short-term response is. They are different products. I mean, you know, the casinos, they're casinos. I mean, they're a big place where you go and you get a different kind of market than going down to the neighborhood tavern and playing on one of six machines. So we don't think there's that much overlap, although there's probably going to be some. And so it probably would increase the state share marginally. So the other thing to keep in mind is that the magnitude of the last recession, biggest percentage decline since the Depression, and you have still a budget that's responding to that, trying to dig out of that very low level that was forced to in that period. Just a reminder to you again, this number continues to grow. Percentage of general fund from personal income tax, 88%. We've got this growing to a little over 90%. It was in the 60s. In the 60s, it was in the 60%. So it's been pretty steadily growing as a share. And, of course, that's because the income tax is elastic. And over time, it's going to grow faster than the other components of the general fund, including corporate income. Corporate cigarette taxes are part of general fund, insurance premium taxes. The only thing that's really grown significantly at, on a percentage basis is estate taxes. And those are highly erratic.
And why is... No, I'm joking.
And then, of course, the lottery is 86% video, 14% traditional. This number will grow as well as the line games fully mature and the traditional games become less and less. And here's, of course, your breakout, keeping in mind that only about 50% of that lottery revenue is available. One of the issues I know that that you have in your work plan is to kind of look at it, the state's long-term debt position and bonding position. Remember, the 13% of lottery money now is currently being used for debt repayment, mostly from the lottery bonds for schools that were issued in 97 and 99. Well, we're still paying for those, and those are 20-year bonds, as I recall. The current economic situation, I mentioned this fifth birthday, so national expansion has been around for a while. Oregon's growth has picked up. Our unemployment is down, although we still are among the higher in the country. And many of our manufacturing jobs have not returned. We do, if you look at kind of the projection, it's based on the assumption that we're going to have a soft spot in 2007. And the state economists will be here to talk with you some more about that. They're scheduled to release on March 1st, and I'm sure they'll talk about that and see if that's coming true. Number of concerns out there as we look ahead. The most prominent of those are housing prices.
I love it.
As you get more creative with your graphics, I like this.
If this trap closes, it means special session. So there's a lot of concern around housing prices, and you know there's been discussion with how that compares with the stock market bubble we experienced at the beginning of the decade. My view on that is that potentially the impact on output and employment could be even bigger. But it's going to be much more spread out because housing markets are not obviously not centralized. They're very regional in nature. So, but home ownership is more broadly distributed than is stock ownership. So more people are potentially affected by a very weak housing market. In Oregon's case, we've seen construction employment grow over 10% each of the last 2 years. So we think that's where we're going to really see the slowing. And that could turn into more of a, more than a slowing. It could turn into actual decline.
Paul, I was talking to a developer recently this in an area that has been very, very stable. There's always influx. People coming up out of California seem to stop at this place. Mm-hmm. So they've been very stable, but he said we have a significant downturn. Where they're sitting on inventory. They're talking about not starting. I see you nodding your head, so apparently you're agreeing that some places that have been stable in housing construction and that construction industry seem to be kind of faltering.
Mm-hmm. Senator George, if you look at our housing prices, the 06 preliminary numbers put us at 17% growth statewide. You know, that's about triple the growth in income. And that would be 2 years in a row of 17% growth. So mm-hmm. we know that's not sustainable. And particularly the kind of increases we've seen in Central Oregon, for example, as well as Southern Oregon, we expect to see considerable slowing in those areas.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Paul, I have read some national studies that show that people during this housing boom have actually been refinancing and then spending the money and that they're actually spending more money than their income. And that on a national level, consumption has exceeded income. And, of course, what troubles me is when that housing boom ends and people can no longer refinance and pull more money out of their equity, then they're either going to go into deeper debt or they're going to spend less, which will cool the economy.
Is there any validity to that?
Or both.
Yeah.
Senator Monroe, yes, definitely. We see that as a big risk. And actually, you know, the kind of scenario you've talked about there, the housing prices leading to overconsumption, is really one of the root causes of the world trade imbalance, because the U.S. is overconsuming relative to its income, and we're in effect sucking in imports, and we have record trade deficits. And that is, I think, in my mind, the biggest fundamental risk out there, is those imbalances at some point have to be corrected. Now, the way you'd like to see them corrected would be for U.S. exports to rise, because that would create jobs. But it's probably going to be some combination of a drop in imports caused by less demand because people can't afford them. And, of course, the mechanism, the traditional mechanism for doing that is the value of the dollar. So the dollar, we think, is going to weaken. That's good for exporters over time, but that's going to be some painful adjustment, I think, for consumers in the U.S. So we expect that to be a real slowing a factor as we look ahead. And potentially, you know, one that could push us into recession if we look at those imbalance causing, you know, a sudden adjustment. Right now, those deficits are largely being financed by Asian investors buying U.S. securities. And that, you know, if that perception changes out there of those buyers of our security, that means higher interest rates, it means a lower value dollar eventually, and it means a more risk to the economy.
I think you answered Senator George's.
That was a question.
International tensions, we know, certainly have the potential, either through affecting commodity prices like oil, but just creating reductions in overall confidence, and that affects the investment climate worldwide.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, so especially China is hoarding American dollars, U.S. dollars. I mean, they're buying up the excess bonds, mm-hmm. And using that as a way of continuing to encourage our market buying their goods. If we come to a point where, because of the rapid decline in the dollar value, or for some other reason, they decide that they're holding enough U.S. securities, or they want to divest themselves of U.S. securities, then that could have a really tragic impact on our overall economic situation.
Yes, Senator, you know, the value of the dollar is just supply and demand for that currency, and if the Chinese demand for that currency, in other words, they're not buying U.S. securities, drops, then you'll see the value drop of the dollar. And that will begin a whole adjustment process. And that adjustment process means less consumption in the United States, number one. And if it's sudden enough, it potentially means recession.
Yeah.
I would see one of the biggest risks, not so much to the state finance system, but to the local finance system under Measure 50, would be a reemergence of inflation. The 3% is fixed. If inflation, say, 6% a year, local governments are going to have a very difficult time meeting increased costs with a property tax base that doesn't respond much to that change. Even if, you know, real estate values will change, will respond to inflation, but the 3% limit would prevent assessed values from changing. And finally, consumer debt, and all of this is related. Consumer debt, Senator Monroe mentioned that part of this is obviously due to the wealth effect, that people see their houses more valuable and they borrow against them. And that could slow spending more than expected, particularly if these prices turn out to be weaker. So there's a lot of risks out there as we look ahead over the next couple of years. Right now, we think that there's enough positives to keep the economy growing in 07 at a slower rate. But certainly any of these risks potentially could tip it into recession. A look at kind of the general fund revenue and kind of the patterns we've followed, strong growth. Here's your 90s. And again, as I said earlier, this all has kicker money pulled out. So these growth patterns would have been even stronger during this period. You do see a little bit more strength in here because of the surcharge. Not a surcharge, but the rate increase, temporary rate increase that I'm sure Senator Monroe remembers in the early 80s in special session on the income tax, where all five of the brackets at that time were increased, and that sustained this higher growth here. But what was happening prior to this period is that with high inflation, revenue growth was 30 to 40% per biennium. And so all of a sudden, here it's over 20%, all of a sudden, without those surcharges, it would have been about zero. So it dropped about 20% below projections. Here's the recovery. Here's the first kicker payments going out. And then you can see the 90s boom beginning in here as corporate income tax took off and personal did, stock market bubble. This, again, is a kicker effect. Here's the final biennium of the stock market bubble. Here's the collapse. Here's where we began to pull out of it, and here's the growth projected now for this biennium, 23%. So we're getting up there close to where we were throughout the 90s. And this would be even a little bit stronger without the corporate kicker credit that's gone out, $101 million this biennium. Here's the effect of the kicker now on projections. Is to actually lead to a decline, less than 1%, but that's because you're pulling $1.3 billion out of the revenue stream from the refunds and the credits. And then, of course, you get the distortion in the next biennium, and it really takes off. So if you kind of look at these projections and looking at the state's ability to sustain spending, a lot of it depends on this growth, this bar popping back up. Here's the long-term growth rate that was anticipated, about 12%. That's kind of the trend that underlies most of these forecasts, about 6% a year. Here's the effect of the kicker.
Senator George.
Paul, but if we took that slide and we did an overlay and we put a line reflecting total expenditure, you would see an almost steady line and then a couple places where it really climbed as far as state expenditures. Is that correct? Or
that's correct, Senator. The spending and revenue lines are pretty close. You do see a bit of a lag usually. What will happen is you build up revenue, will exceed expectations, and then you see a catch-up as those balances are spent. If you look at kind of the percentages compared to personal income, their general fund and all fund spending is a little bit higher than personal income, but pretty close over the last 20 years. One of the things that I did in this kicker report was to try to take a different look at the kicker going forward. And in the past, we'd always said, well, you know, we can't forecast the kicker because we can't forecast the forecast. And so we just assumed it was zero. But we have enough history back through here. And in fact, what I did was some of these years, for example, in 89-91 or 91-93 and 93-95, you don't see any kicker there, but there would have been if the legislature hadn't suspended the kicker. In the 01-03, remember the Muppel bill? I'm sure Senator George does.
We got two thumbs bill, up on that one.
That was two. That was, yeah, two lawsuits, but whatever.
But that modified the size of this kicker by about $108 million. Well, you know, going forward with a kicker operating in the Constitution, it's unlikely you're going to see those kind of modifications. Certainly, they're a lot more difficult. So what I did was add those changes back in and look forward, and the kicker has averaged about 3% of general fund revenue. And that's what these projections are here. And so if you go ahead to 11-13, for example, general fund revenue is about $15 billion. So 3% is about $500 million. So it's not insignificant. Now what's going to happen is you may get a zero there and then a billion the next biennium. But it's going to average about 3% of general fund revenue. And of course the real outlier is the current one. And you can see where that really stands out. It's 10.9% of revenue, the revenue projected. So you really have an unprecedented kicker coming into play in 07-09 under current law. Here's your numbers looking ahead. Beginning balance, of course, is huge because of the revenue above expectations. And that, as the kicker comes out of this, you get much lower revenue growth here. Corporate dropping off because of the kicker. And then you've got In terms of total general fund resources, 6.8% growth coming off the 23.3 here. Again, that's all reduced by the kicker, even though you got the bigger beginning balance. Lottery resources, 37% in 03-05, and slowing here to 20, but we think eventually probably slowing down in the neighborhood of 10 to 12% per biennium in the lottery. But right now, we're still above that trend. If you look at resource growth in the current biennium, it's 24.2%. But this drops to 8.4 because of the kicker largely. But keep in mind that this 14.1, you're only spending about 13.1 of that, or actually even less than that, about 12.9. So you have this big beginning balance you're pushing forward. So if you look at the revenue, the expenditures for general fund and lottery for 03-05, or for 05-07, and you say, well, how much could we spend in 07-09 if these projections, this 15.3 is right? The answer is you could increase spending by about 19.5% over where you're at right now. That would exclude the stability fund and the $150 million traditional kind of ending balance. Now, everybody's talking about a bigger amount, but that would, just assuming that traditional amount, you could increase spending by 19.5%.
So, Paul, those are outstanding big numbers. And I don't know if you know this offhand, but where would that put us if you reflect back to 5 years instead of just looking at the current two-year look? Do you know, would that basically catch us up to where we were in 01, 03? Say we went 19% increase. Mm-hmm. Would that fully catch us up to where we were after the cuts of the last recession, or would we still be...
I would say offhand, Mr. Chair, I think you would still be behind. But kind of what we've taken as a baseline is to take your 0103 close of session budget. And I've got that here in a minute. Take that number and project it out based on costs. My guess is you would still be below that, but I'll check that for sure when you account for inflation and other kinds of normal costs.
Okay.
So that 0103, of course, we cut about 13% off of that number when all was said and done in the 0103 biennium.
So it would be an accurate statement to say the state actually spends less, even with the 19%. I don't think that's going to occur.
I think so, but uh-huh. let me make sure of that for you so that you make sure that that's right. But I think that's the case. Okay. I'll check that.
Mr. Yeah, the kicker is something that I've been watching for since it came in 20 years, and it people misunderstand it, of course, but the real problem we all know is that we can't accurately forecast what our income tax and corporate tax rates are going to drive in terms of numbers. Sometimes we're wrong. In fact, we're always wrong. And those people responsible for doing those forecasts tend to come in at a conservative number. And we want them to come in at a conservative number. We don't want them to say we're going to have this much revenue and it's only this much, because then all the budgets have to be cut, all the budgets that are approved. So they tend to come in at a conservative number. I've heard it suggested that perhaps we should change the way we forecast to forecast a range, a high and a low. Budget on the low, but have the high of the range be what triggers the kicker or doesn't trigger the kicker. What would be involved in changing the law to allow us to do it that way?
Senator, that's been discussed, I think, a fair amount in this, you know, looking at the latest kicker numbers, I think have triggered some of that. Technically, that would not be difficult. I think it's more of a legal issue, and in my discussions with counsel, putting the kicker in the Constitution really restricts what you can, your flexibility, obviously. And that would be the issue, is can you change the interpretation of what is, quote, the close of session forecast? What the Constitution says is the governor shall have prepared a forecast of all general fund revenue. And so what does that mean? I mean, that would be a legal issue. And I know that when I've talked with counsel about that, they've expressed concerns.
So that would be a question to address. We could ask them to address more fully, but that would be the constraint.
And the second question then would be, if we're moving to an annual session, an off-year budget session, is there any possibility of us only forecasting 1 year at a time instead of 2 years, so that we can be more accurate in our forecast, so that we can update our forecast annually instead of biannually?
Again, Senator, the language for the kicker is in the Constitution. It does call for a biennial forecast, so that could be changed, but I think that's probably the route you'd have to go if you're to go to a one-year kind of kicker base and kicker calculation.
So we'll take a public vote.
I would think so, yes.
Okay, so finally getting to the topic here, which is the next rainy day. Remind you of the Education Stability Fund, and I did put kind of a little summary sheet for you that we try to do with each forecast, just to remind you what the numbers look like and what the characteristics are of the Education Stability Fund, which is serves really at this point as the state's rainy day fund. Created in 2002, it is dedicated to public education, 18% of lottery earnings. What that means is, of course, with the lottery revenue growth of 37% and exceeding expectations, that means that growth of the stability fund has increased beyond what we had anticipated at the beginning of the session and well beyond what we expected back in 2002 when the fund was first put before voters. We had expected, and I'm thinking, about 2013-15 was when we thought we'd begin to approach the 5% cap under those initial projections. Now, if you look on your chart I've got there, we're above the cap in the 2009-11 biennium, and our projections put us at actually $69 million above the cap. Those dollars under the Constitution now would flow into a subaccount for school capital, school matching capital subaccount, which has not been defined how that's to be used. The Senate Interim Commission on Education Excellence does have a bill that they recommended the way that money should be spent and allocated, so that's something that will probably come to this committee for you to look at. In fact, I think we may have it in committee now. So, of course, these projections that you look at all assume that you don't have to go into the fund. So in the next recession, obviously, those dollars will be there. The cap now is at 5%, and at the end of the current biennium, we're expecting about $227 million in the fund, and at the end of 2007-09, about $451 million. Now, if you compare that with where we were at in 2001-03, the shortfall, and here I'm measuring it by taking the amount of revenue that came in, absent any legislative changes, pulling out the appropriation credit bond and so forth, and the special session actions you took, and comparing that with what actually came in, the close of session forecast versus what actually came in, it was about $2.4 billion under projections. Or 20.6%. And that is pretty close to the 81-83 shortfall relative to the forecast in percentage terms. So that, you know, as we're looking out at the post-war history, those were the two biennia where we could look at as you know, a worst-case scenario based on history. So 20% would be kind of a, you know, the extreme case. Now, if we look again also at kind of how the state responded to that recession, you can see that the change in tax revenue, this is the bottom of the recession, is about 5.6%, and Oregon dropped about 20% compared to the prior biennium, the prior fiscal year, 2002 versus 2001. So in terms of percentage drops here, Oregon was second only to Alaska in its percentage decline. So as you look ahead, this is looking at the budget reductions, and this gets kind of a little bit at the chair's issue about are we back to that 0103 adopted level. What I'll do to answer the chair's question is take this 11974 and project costs out and see where that puts us compared to our 0709 projection to give you a sense of whether that could have been met. Of course, what was actually spent was the 10468, which was a 12.6% reduction. And of course, you can see the reductions that occurred. Finally, the last slide here for you, the policy questions to address as you're thinking in terms of a reserve fund. One is, are revenue sources adequate? You've got an 18% constitutionally dedicated revenue source. You have seen rapid growth, but you know we do think that's going to slow in the neighborhood of say 5% a year when the line games mature. So your issue is, should you develop additional revenue sources? Of course, those don't have to be constitutional. You can have statutory revenue sources flow into that fund. Is the cap too low? And the Senate, as you recall, last session passed a joint resolution to raise the cap from 5% of general fund revenue to 10. And I think I've seen that bill again this session. So that will be an issue to discuss. If you're talking about covering a 20% shortfall, it obviously is too low. But there are other things to think about when you look at that stability fund. There are those who argue, well, you don't want to cover the whole thing. You want to require some efficiencies, some, if the private sector is declining, there should be some decline in the public sector. You hear those kind of arguments.
Who says that, Paul?
I did a few times talking about efficiency.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Senator George did. I knew I heard it somewhere. Are the uses broad enough? Well, the current Education Stability Fund is dedicated to public education. Of course, that's 60% of your general fund budget. But still, it does have some limits on it. It is not a general purpose reserve fund. We all know you could do some backfill to manipulate that number, but again, it's not general purpose. And the other question is, do the triggers ensure appropriate use of the fund? Right now, we have triggers that are tied to the budget, the revenue forecast. If it falls by 2%, then you can get into the fund. Or if the economy declines for 6 months, employment declines. But the key trigger for any of those is that you got a 3/5 vote. So that always becomes an issue. Are those triggers adequate to ensure appropriate use, meaning that you can use it when you need it, but not use it when, at other times when it may not be needed as much. So those are kind of the issues looking ahead.
So this may have been, yes, Senator Stark.
I'm sorry to interrupt. It just seems to me that after this overview, and we saw the charts where, Oregon revenues almost always have been higher. Almost always, we talked about the tall green bars. Almost always more than 10%. It seems to me, and this goes back to a statement from Senator George, that if we had been judicious in our budgeting, had capped, the increase in state government spending at 12% and banked the rest, that when it came time to that recession, that monies would be there and available for us to spend and not have to go through the cuts that we all lived through. What it requires is discipline. And this legislature, I don't think, has exhibited much of any of that, and hopefully going forward, then that we can do. It doesn't require a constitutional amendment. It doesn't require a big change. All it requires is discipline. We don't have to do anything other than save revenues during good times so that we have them during the bad times. And I think clearly that's the message that I came away from this morning. $450 million when you need $2.5 billion. It really demonstrates that we have not, as an institution, as a body, over the years that I've been around here, exhibited any fiscal discipline whatsoever.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I concur. I I've read my Old Testament, the story of Joseph and the five fat cows and the five skinny cows and so on, and believe that during good times we ought to be putting aside for bad times. But you need to understand that during the early 90s, we were reacting to Measure 5. School funding was being drastically cut from property taxes, and the state was being asked to backfill what had been covered by property taxes. And so that's part of the reason, anyway, why state budgets tended to increase faster than the inflation. It was to make up for lost revenue to local governments.
So, Paul, if in terms of the stability fund, at what point, and you may have addressed this, would we hit, what year are we projected now to hit 10% or 5% of general fund or 5% reserves? If we just, if this legislature did nothing but let the stability fund grow?
Mr. Chair, you've got this, cheat sheet table that I do every forecast. It's just a one pager there. You can see in the chart there, we're actually hitting the 5% cap during the 2009-11 biennium. And if the current projection holds, you'd have $69 million in the school capital fund on July 1 of 2011. So we'll hit it. You know, we're looking at 2007-2009, so we're saying that the following biennium, you're going to hit that cap under the current projections, assuming we don't have to go into the fund between now and then. So the 5% is coming up. So that's why my advice to you would be to review that and look and make sure that's the cap you want. And if it is, then to flush out how you want that school capital matching fund to work. You've got a bill now in this committee that came from the Commission on Education Excellence that has a certain way. So that will be a topic for you to look at, because that's coming sooner than we told you before, given the kind of revenue growth we've seen in lottery.
And so if we want to get, and I don't know where the mythical $1 billion where that figure came from in terms of reserves for 2007-2009 with the growth, so it's roughly just under $400 million if you assume the continued growth of the Education Stability Fund without taking any funds from that.
Yes, the Education Stability Fund would get to 451 at the end of 2007-2009. The cap would be 635. So you'd still be below that cap at the end of this coming biennium.
And then it spills over. Okay, so then you get into the whole school capital conversation, because
right.
The spillover goes into school capital.
Right, in 2007-2009 you go, because you get $248 million in revenue growth projected for 2009-11. And, of course, the revenue growth drops off in 2011-13 because you go from 18 to 15% in the dedication, and that's built into the Constitution. The school capital fund will operate differently. For example, it would just require a majority vote to allocate money out of that sub-account. It wouldn't take the 3/5 as it would out of the stability account.
Other questions and thoughts on are we prepared for the next recession? Senator Starr.
I just one question. From your experience, does it make sense? What's the right reserve? Is 10% the right reserve? Is 15% the right reserve? What's the national average of states? The states that do have a reserve. Talk a little bit about those issues.
Senator, we actually remember this in the spring and summer of 2002, and when this was prepared by the Special Budget Committee, and we looked at NCSL documents at that time, and we had actually done some work looking at kind of the average recession and what would be a reasonable fund. We, of course, knew about the 81-83 period, but the number we settled on, they asked us that, and then basically we came up with 5%, because that was the NCSL recommendation to meet a kind of an average recession, not certainly a worst-case scenario. But now, with the experience of 2001-03, in which, remember, these declines we experienced were the most since the Depression, not only in Oregon, but for state governments in general. So there's something else going on there. We think, of course, our personal income tax connection is a huge factor, and we think the personal income tax is becoming more volatile. So our recommendation is that you should be looking at higher than 5%, and we've seen 10% mentioned quite a bit more. I think that's about where NCSL is coming down, is what would be a reasonable amount. Certainly even that's not going to protect you against a 0103 type decline, but it would give you a lot more coverage than the 5%. We see, and I know the state economist's office has talked with you about this, but you know, you look at those components of income, and we'll talk with you some about this tomorrow too when Chris does the income tax numbers. You know, those components, the volatile components, is where we're seeing the big growth. I mean, it's capital gains, it's Schedule E, business income. So we think that the income tax is becoming more volatile, even though the underlying economy is probably becoming less volatile. It's just the way we're being paid and the way the system is working, that wages and prices are more flexible than they used to be, and that means that, you know, income tax revenue is going to be more volatile. Where we get hit on the income tax is not the blue collar worker being laid off. We get hit from the investor or somebody making $400,000 or $500,000 a year. Then business is bad, or consulting business, or they lose investment income. They go down to $100,000 to $150,000. Well, they're not in the streets, but that's a huge loss on the income tax because we're getting a full 9% of that. Remember that nearly half of our income tax collections come from people over $100,000. So that's where the volatility is, and we think that's going to increase. So our recommendation is to look closely to 5%, and probably doesn't necessarily mean this fund should be increased to 5%, but to look at reserves in the 10% neighborhood from this or this and some other sources.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
Since we're one of the highest volatility states, wouldn't it make more sense to look at the NCSL recommendation, which is an average of all the states, which are far less volatile than Oregon, by and large? Wouldn't it make more sense to look at that as a bare minimum and to really strive for something higher than that, which would take into account, for example, you know, we lost 20% in that worst case. So wouldn't something more in the range of 12 to 15% for Oregon make more sense?
Mm-hmm. Senator, I think, you know, it gets into, you know, kind of calculations you have to make as a policymaker, and kind of a risk-reward kind of thing. Those dollars you pull out of the system are dollars you don't have available to allocate. So there are costs associated with that, too. I mean, obviously, you can do other things with those dollars. So you have to kind of weigh those trade-offs. I would say, in my view, yes, I think you can make a strong case that it should be higher because of the volatility in the state. I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, Oregon definitely found itself in the worst of both worlds, having the volatility and then inadequate reserves, which just and a unique kicker law. So you had three factors all in play at once. And I don't know. I mean, I'd be curious anywhere trying to experience all three of those, not just states, but because forecasting. I mean, when you were talking about Schedule E, investor, even this new issue that seems to be emerging, it's just the hardest to forecast. You were the state economist. I would guess those, to me, unlike that blue-collar worker, which you can probably predict pretty easily, those are the hardest to predict and forecast, especially in the out years, which were, depending on what, 12% growth.
Yes, Mr. Chair, those are hard to predict. We don't have any problems with the 12% trend. We think that's pretty reasonable. And I know Senator Monroe has mentioned that he thought the forecasts do tend to be conservative. But we think kind of more what happens is you have a trend out there, and that trend may be pretty close, but you're just moving up and down that trend. And the forecasters are just not good at timing when that's going to happen. And so, you know, you tend to be low, and then when you're above that, and, you know, on average, you may be right. But, you know, from biennium to biennium, you're going to be way above or below that trend, and that's back to the revenue system and its volatility.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other...
We're going to fix it, though, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. We're...
it's Martin Luther King Day, so this is a day of, you know, great hope and optimism. So thank you, Paul. We'll continue this tomorrow morning at 8:30 and get into are we destined to relive the greatest recession since the last depression? We're into titles and marketing, so that will be the income tax and corporate income tax tomorrow with Chris. Thank you, Paul. Do we have coffee in the morning? Are we still?
We don't, but we could look into arranging that if that's the desire
sure
of the committee.
Like that.
The folks want that
coffee.
That was one of those big spender Republican things.
Tea.
I think we need to cut it out.
Coffee and tea. And Senator Starr used to bring bread the older
Senator. Oh, yeah.
And Randy used to bring donuts.
We are.
You wouldn't want the
coffee.